Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events and issues. The event we're analyzing today is McCarthyism. Very few people get an ism named after them. An ism is defined as a distinctive practice, system, or political ideology. Former U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy from the state of Wisconsin has an ism named for him, but not in a good way. If you're not familiar with that term McCarthyism, it's the political practice of making wild accusations of disloyalty, sedition, or treason without any kind of evidence that would hold up in court. In the early 1950s, Joe McCarthy conducted a witch hunt on the national stage against supposed communists in the U.S. government. McCarthy fanned the flames of the Red Scare in America. Joe McCarthy certainly did not create the Red Scare, but he wrote it to become the most feared man in America in the early 1950s. So, what is a Red Scare? It's a widespread fear of a supposed threat of a communist takeover in a free country like the U.S. Although there were Red Scares in other countries, I'm going to be focusing on the Red Scares in the United States in the 20th century. In the U.S., people were right to fear communist countries. Don't get me wrong, the fears of a communist takeover in America were not legitimate, and Americans certainly should not have taken the actions that were taken in response to these Red Scares in the U.S. But the fear and loathing of the communist regimes of the 20th century were certainly justified. These were horrible forms of government. The USSR was probably the worst government in history after Nazi Germany. The Soviet Union was at its nadir during the merciless dictatorship of Joseph Stalin from the mid to late 1920s until his death in 1953. Unfortunately, there's no consensus for how many deaths are attributable to Joseph Stalin. Estimates range from 9 million to 20 million Soviet citizens died as a result of Stalin. These include outright executions, people being worked to death in the Gulag prison camps, and possibly the worst was the Holodomor. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that term, but I hear it pronounced several ways. The Holodomor was a man-made famine in the Soviet Union in the early 1930s. I say man-made because it resulted from Joseph Stalin and his policies of collectivization of agriculture, along with the extremely harsh penalties for anybody who resisted collective farming. The Holodomor resulted in the deaths of approximately 4 million or more Ukrainians. Unfortunately, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union in those days. By the way, I know that 9 to 20 million is an incredibly broad range of deaths attributable to Stalin. But whatever is the actual total of deaths of Soviet citizens caused by Stalin, it's an insane amount. You get my point that this was a despicable regime. And the Soviet Union was expansionist. The Soviets supported communist takeovers in other countries. The most successful occurred in Eastern Europe. At the end of World War II, the enormous Red Army occupied most of Eastern Europe. As a result, communist governments were set up in Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, which of course is now two separate countries, the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and the former country of East Germany. These were brutal, repressive governments. The best example of how bad they were is the fact that East Germany had to build a wall around West Berlin to keep their citizens from escaping. What does that tell you, that a government is so horrendous that they have to keep people in the country by force? And it wasn't just the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe that was frightening. Another horrible example was China. Things in China were certainly at their worst when Mao Zedong, usually referred to as Chairman Mao, was the head of the government. After World War II, there was a civil war in China, which, unfortunately for the Chinese people, the communists won. The People's Republic of China was declared in 1949. During the brutal reign of Chairman Mao, an estimated 40 to 80 million Chinese citizens died as a result of man-made famine, disease, as well as torture and execution. Again, that's an incredibly broad range, but whatever the actual number of deaths caused by the policies of Chairman Mao, it was one of the greatest horrors in the history of the world. Regrettably for the Chinese people and the rest of the world, the Chinese Communist government never fell like the communist governments in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. In case you think that these appalling communist regimes were just a problem of the 20th century, think about North Korea. There are several terrible governments in existence right now, but the communist dictatorship in North Korea gets my vote as the worst in the world. It's funny. If you say that you are anti-fascist, nobody thinks you are a reactionary. Except for people on the lunatic fringe, it's hard to find anyone who admires the Nazis or other fascist dictatorships. Yes, sometimes an anti-communist bias is seen as an intolerant position. However, as I just demonstrated, communist governments were and are horrendous. Just because Hitler and his insane cronies get the title of being the worst regime in history doesn't mean that governments like Stalinist USSR or Chairman Mao's China were not absolutely terrifying. My point in all of this is that any rational person would not want to see Hitler's National Socialist Party take over the United States, but also they would not want to see communist dictatorships like those under Joseph Stalin or Chairman Mao. Now I get to the giant, but although I agree that such repressive and murderous totalitarian governments are something that any reasonable individual would want to avoid, that does not justify the tactics of Senator Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s. The U.S. public was already in the midst of a Red Scare when McCarthy burst on the scene in February 1950. Since the end of World War II in 1945, the world had descended into the Cold War. The two sides were generally referenced as the Communist Bloc and the West. 1949 had been a very bad year for the West. As I mentioned earlier, Chairman Mao and his communists had been successful in the Civil War in China. Mao declared the founding of the People's Republic of China on October 1, 1949, in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. The largest nation in the world by population, at least at that time, now joined the Soviet Union, the largest country by area, as communist behemoths. There was even worse news on the nuclear front. Since the summer of 1945, the U.S. had enjoyed a nuclear monopoly. America was the only country in the world with atomic weapons. That changed on August 29, 1949, when the USSR exploded an atomic bomb. This meant that any war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union would probably involve a nuclear exchange, meaning that there could be no winners and everybody would be a loser. This rightly scared the hell out of the entire world. Americans were right to fear the Soviet Union, just as they were right to fear Nazi Germany and imperialist Japan. But before World War II, there was not this paranoia that there were Americans looking to overthrow our system of government and replace it with either a Nazi regime or a government in league with imperialist Japan. It's funny because before World War II, the German America Bund was a pro-Nazi organization in the U.S. They even held a rally in Madison Square Garden on February 20, 1939, with 22,000 members in attendance. But these American Nazis did not set off widespread paranoia of an overthrow of the American government like the fear of communism after World War II. America has a long and sad history of overreacting to possible communist subversion. Ever since the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, Americans have been afraid that something like that could happen here in the U.S. This reached a fever pitch in 1919 when the Communist Party of the USA was founded. In that same year, 1919, Anarchists mailed or hand-delivered bombs to government officials and business executives. One such bomb blew up the front of the home of the Attorney General at that time, A. Mitchell Palmer. And no, he's not any relation to me. This led to a crackdown which is known as the Palmer Raids. Palmer assigned the Bureau of Investigation, the precursor to the FBI, to investigate these anarchists. He put in charge a young lawyer named J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover and his crew supplied Attorney General Palmer with the names of thousands of political dissidents. On November 12, 1919, Hoover and his agents arrested approximately 1,000 purported political radicals. All of this was under the authority of Attorney General Palmer. More raids would follow, with thousands more arrested as political subversives. Many were deported. The House Un-American Activities Committee started in 1938. It was known as HUAC, H-U-A-C. This was before World War II. And I know some of you want to yell at me that the war had already started in 1937 between Japan and China. And although that was a massive war, it did not become a world war until the Nazis invaded Poland on September 1, 1939. UAC was created to investigate alleged disloyalty and subversive activities on the part of private Americans, public employees, and organizations suspected of subversive activity. Harry Truman called UAC more un-American than the activities it was investigating. Before World War II, UAC investigated domestic fascist groups. After the war, its target was switched to real or alleged communists. In 1939, Congress passed the Hatch Act, which prohibited any government employees who advocated the overthrow of our constitutional form of government in the United States. Today, federal law prohibits government employees from supporting the overthrow of the U.S. government or being a member of an organization that promotes the overthrow of our government. Title V of the United States Code, Section 7311, reads in pertinent part as follows. An individual may not accept or hold a position in the government of the United States or the government of the District of Columbia if he, 1, advocates the overthrow of our constitutional form of government, 2, is a member of an organization that he knows advocates the overthrow of our constitutional form of government. On March 21, 1947, President Truman signed Executive Order 9835. This instituted the loyalty program. All federal employees and applicants had to be checked by the FBI to see if they were communists or belonged to some other subversive group. The Communist Party USA hit its peak in that year, 1947, with over 82,000 members. After that, it greatly declined. Even with the Hatch Act, the Truman Loyalty Program, and other related laws, it wasn't illegal to be a communist. And I know that some of you are thinking, hey, what about the Communist Control Act of 1954? It's true, that was a federal statute. It was rarely enforced. Also, a federal court ruled that the act was unconstitutional. That was the U.S. District Court for the District of Arizona. The case was Blawis, B-L-A-W-I-S, versus Bolin, B-O-L-I-N. The citation is 358, Federal Supplement 349, and that's a 1973 case. The U.S. Supreme Court greatly limited its impact in the case of Communist Party USA versus Catherwood. That's found at 367 U.S. 389. It's a 1961 case. So with those limitations in mind, for all practical purposes, it wasn't illegal to be a communist. However, it was illegal to be a member of the Communist Party or any other subversive group if you were a federal employee. The United States is a free country. People are allowed to believe extremist political ideologies provided, 1, that they do not act on them, such as attempts to overthrow the government, or 2, they are not government employees. I think most reasonable people would agree that, even in a free country, we cannot tolerate people attempting to overthrow the government or working for the government if they have such political aspirations. Before World War II, communism appealed to some Americans at least in the 1930s. This was during the Great Depression. Some naive people were looking at communism as some utopian society. They did not understand the harsh realities. They did not know how murderous the government in the Soviet Union was. I'm not excusing these political beliefs. I'm just explaining how some naive Americans might have thought that way during the Great Depression. And then, during World War II, Joseph Stalin and his horrendous government were our allies. So there was not a lot of bad press about the Soviets during that time. But after World War II, the Cold War started. Even people who were innocent and ignorant about the Soviets before the war started to see what the USSR really was. This was not a workers' paradise where everybody could be equal. What was going on in the Soviet Union, and then in Eastern Europe, as well as China and North Korea, was brutal repression. An iron fist crushing any semblance of freedom and killing millions of their own citizens. Before I discuss McCarthy, we first have to acknowledge that there had been Soviet spies. First, let's deal with Klaus Fuchs. As you might have guessed from his name, Klaus Fuchs was a German citizen. He was a member of the German Communist Party. He had to flee his homeland in 1933 when the Nazis came to power. Hitler and his henchmen were not very tolerant of communists. Actually, I'm not sure why I just limited that to communists. The Nazis were intolerant of anybody other than their own lunatic group. Fuchs moved to the UK where he got his doctorate in physics. During the war, he worked on the Tube Alloys nuclear weapons program. In 1943, Fuchs was sent to the U.S. to work on the Manhattan Project. That was the project which developed the first atomic bombs. Fuchs continued working on the Manhattan Project, developing nuclear weapons, until the end of World War II. Unfortunately, in 1949, it was discovered that Klaus Fuchs was a spy for the Soviet Union. He had been passing along nuclear secrets to the Soviets. How did the Americans and British discover that there was a high-level spy in the Manhattan Project? It was because of the Venona Project. That's spelled V-E-N-O-N-A. It was a program run by the U.S. Army's Signal Intelligence Service to intercept and decode messages by the Soviet intelligence agencies. That meant the KGB, the GRU, and the NKVD. The Venona Project started in 1943 because, although the Soviets were supposedly allies with the US, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, no reasonable person trusted Joseph Stalin. One of the many fears of the Western allies was that a separate peace might be negotiated between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. We now look back and understand the intense hatred between those two governments and that the war on the Eastern Front was a fight to the absolute finish. But during World War II, this was a genuine concern. In August 1939, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was a peace agreement between Hitler and Stalin. They agreed not to attack each other and to divide Poland in half. And as a bonus, Stalin also got the three Baltic republics of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. So the Western allies were right to be suspicious of their supposed partner, Joseph Stalin. Anyway, this is what led to the start of the Venona Project. That counterintelligence operation continued after World War II. Obviously, it was even more important during the Cold War. The Venona Project ran until 1980. After the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of the information from Venona was released. In 1995, the U.S. government said approximately 350 Americans had been spying for the Soviets at various times. Decoded messages from the Soviet intelligence agencies in 1949 confirmed that there was a spy in the nuclear weapons program. MI5, the security service of the UK, had already suspected Klaus Fuchs of being a spy. Fuchs was arrested in early 1950 in the UK. He was convicted and sentenced to 14 years. After 9 years in prison, he was released in 1959 and moved to the communist state of East Germany. In the U.S., The most famous spy case of the 20th century involved Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They were a married couple from New York City who were convicted of spying for the Soviet Union in 1951. They both received the death penalty and were executed on June 19, 1953. They both died in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison in New York State. For years afterwards, people debated whether or not the Rosenbergs were actually guilty or were simply the victims of the Red Scare and anti-Semitism. In 2015, 91-year-old Morton Sobel, a co-defendant in the Rosenberg trial, finally admitted that he and Julius had been Soviet agents. Up until that time, Sobel had always professed his innocence. Information from the Venona Project shows that Julius was definitely a spy for the Soviets. Some people still assert that Ethel was innocent, but the decrypted Soviet messages from the Venona Project show that people in Stalin's government viewed both Julius and Ethel as valuable assets. Ethel recruited her brother, David Greenglass, to work with Julius. David Greenglass stole secrets from the Manhattan Project and passed them along to Julius Rosenberg. Evidence also shows that Ethel concealed money and spy equipment for Julius and helped with the contacts with Soviet intelligence. Here's a little known fact. The Rosenbergs were not charged with treason. This was because when they were passing along secrets to the USSR, the Soviets were our allies during World War II. The Rosenbergs were charged and convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. One of the prosecuting attorneys in the Rosenberg case was a young lawyer named Roy Cohn. You're going to hear a lot more about him later on. As I've laid out, there were Soviet spies in America and Britain, but that did not justify the despicable tactics of Joseph McCarthy. And before I outline that period in U.S. history known as McCarthyism, keep one fact in mind. Joseph McCarthy never sent a single subversive person to prison. Not one. He ruined a lot of people's lives, but he never did uncover any Soviet agents or American communists working for Joseph Stalin. In 1953, Arthur Miller wrote one of his most famous plays, The Crucible. Miller is considered one of the greatest American playwrights of the 20th century. His 1949 play, Death of a Salesman, won the Pulitzer Prize. He's also famous for being the third husband of the actress Marilyn Monroe. They were married from 1956 until their divorce in 1961. The Crucible is a fictionalized version of the Salem witch trials of 1692, which took place in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. But The Crucible is actually an allegory of Joseph McCarthy's unjust and oppressive tactics. In 1953, American author Ray Bradbury published a novel titled Fahrenheit 451. This was also in response to McCarthyism. In the novel, the government has strict laws against books, including firemen burning down homes suspected of housing secret stockpiles of books. So who was Joe McCarthy? He was born in Wisconsin in 1908 and remained a Wisconsin resident for the rest of his life. He went to Marquette University in Milwaukee for both undergrad and law school. He worked for a few years as an attorney and then was elected a district circuit judge in Wisconsin. In World War II, he enlisted in the Marines. Because of his college education, he was commissioned an officer. McCarthy was an intelligence briefing officer for a Marine Air Squadron in the Pacific. There's a lot of controversy as to whether or not he actually saw any combat. He probably did not. Apparently, he flew several missions in the rear seat as a gunner observer. But it seems that he was just an observer on these missions and that they were not actual combat missions. Although he was in the tail gunner seat, he never had to shoot at a Japanese plane or any military target. He got the nickname Tail Gunner Joe. He loved the nickname and did not seem to realize that people were goofing on him and using it in a disparaging manner. But after the war, McCarthy exaggerated his military experience. In 1946, McCarthy was elected to the U.S. Senate representing the state of Wisconsin. He was only 39 years old when he was sworn into office, very young for a senator. His first 3 years in the Senate were unremarkable, but everything changed on February 9, 1950. McCarthy had been invited to speak at a Lincoln Day function. Abraham Lincoln had been the first Republican president. Every year around his birthday, which is February 12, Republican organizations around the country would hold Lincoln Day luncheons or dinners. This was not a big-time event. McCarthy was the speaker for the Republican Women's Club of Wheeling, West Virginia. We do not have an audio recording of McCarthy's speech from that day, so there's some controversy as to exactly what he said. But generally, people agree that he held up a piece of paper and said that it contained a list of known communists working for the U.S. State Department. McCarthy said that there were 205 names on that list and that they were known members of the Communist Party. And further, McCarthy claimed that the Secretary of State was aware of these 205 communists working in the State Department, but allowed them to continue working for the American government. The next day in Salt Lake City, McCarthy stated that there were 57 card-carrying members of the Communist Party working in the State Department. By the way, I love that term, card-carrying members of the Communist Party. It's true that the Communist Party USA at one time issued membership cards, but they stopped doing so when they realized that it was a liability. And it's very difficult to believe that any potential subversive working in the State Department would carry a Communist Party membership card as he or she went to work for the federal government. If somebody saw the Communist Party card, it could lead to that federal employee's arrest. Getting back to the number of subversives in the State Department. Which was it? Were there 205 communists in the State Department or 57? Whatever the number, this was a shocking allegation. In 1950, Democrat Harry Truman was president. He had become president in April 1945 when Franklin Roosevelt died of natural causes and Truman was elevated from vice president. In 1948, Truman ran for re-election and won one of the most famous campaigns in American history. All of the national polls said that Truman would easily lose to the Republican candidate Thomas E. Dewey, the governor of New York State. The publishers of the Chicago Tribune, one of the nation's leading newspapers, thought that it was a foregone conclusion, and so, on November 3, 1948, printed the famous headline, "Dewey Defeats Truman." There are photos of Harry Truman holding up that front page of the Chicago Tribune and laughing. Truman's Secretary of State in 1950 was Dean Acheson. He served as Secretary of State from January 1949 until the end of Truman's presidency in January 1953. American senators and representatives often go after the administration when it's the opposing party. And that was the case here with the Republican McCarthy going after the Democrats, Truman and Acheson. But these accusations were way over the line. McCarthy was accusing the president and the Secretary of State of allowing 205 members of the Communist Party to work in the U.S. Department of State. As I mentioned earlier, it's illegal for a federal government employee to be a member of the Communist Party or any other organization which advocates the overthrow of our democratic form of government. So why would Truman and Acheson allow communists to work in the State Department? This was a ridiculous claim. And it's not like Truman had been tough on Stalin and the communist bloc. On March 12, 1947, the president delivered a speech to a joint session of Congress in which he announced the policy which became known as the Truman Doctrine. As described on the U.S. State Department website, with the Truman Doctrine, President Harry S. Truman established that the United States would provide political, military, and economic assistance to all democratic nations under threat from external or internal authoritarian forces. The Truman Doctrine effectively reoriented U.S. foreign policy away from its usual stance of withdrawal from regional conflicts not directly involving the United States to one of possible intervention in faraway conflicts. What prompted this declaration was a civil war in Greece. Communist forces were trying to overthrow the democratic government. And in that same part of the world, the Soviet Union was pressuring the government in Turkey for joint control of the Turkish Straits. That means the straits connecting the Black Sea to the Aegean Sea. The Western allies did not want to see Joseph Stalin sending troops to gain control of the Turkish Straits. The UK had been providing assistance to the democratic forces in Greece, but the British government announced that they could no longer afford to do so. The UK had been on the winning side of World War II, but the war left it broke and no longer a world power. In the first couple of decades after World War II, the British Empire was systematically dismantled. What Truman was arguing was that if Britain could not afford to help democratic governments such as Greece or Turkey, the United States would have to step in and provide whatever assistance was necessary. Truman asked Congress to send $400 million worth of aid to the Greek and Turkish governments, as well as sending civilian and military personnel along with military equipment to those two countries. Congress approved those measures. That would be worth about $5.5 billion in today's money. In addition to the Truman Doctrine, the Truman administration committed the United States to preventing the expansion of the Soviet bloc with the Marshall Plan. The Economic Recovery Act of 1948 is popularly known as the Marshall Plan. It was named for George Marshall, who was Secretary of State at that time. Under the Marshall Plan, the United States spent $13.3 billion to rebuild Western Europe. Obviously, that was a lot of money, and that would be worth about $165 billion today. Part of that was a humanitarian gesture. It was to rebuild the countries of Europe which had been devastated in World War II. And one of the goals was to prevent those countries from falling to communism. The Marshall Plan benefited the United States in providing markets for American goods, creating reliable trading partners, and most importantly, establishing stable democratic governments throughout Western Europe. And Truman was not just trying to stop the spread of communism in Europe. On June 25, 1950, communist North Korean troops poured over the 38th parallel into the democracy of South Korea. Truman immediately organized a coalition under the United Nations to oppose communist aggression in Korea. You might wonder how the UN was able to sanction a war against the communist North Koreans. Permanent members of the UN Security Council could veto any motion. The five permanent members on the UN Security Council in 1950 were the US, Britain, France, the Soviet Union, and China. Of course, this raises the question of which Chinese government? Here's the answer. In 1950, the United Nations recognized Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist government as the legitimate representatives of China. After losing the Chinese Civil War the year before, Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist government were limited to the island of Taiwan. But it was Chiang Kai-shek's government which had the veto in the UN, not Chairman Mao and his communist government in Beijing. In protest of this situation, the Soviets were boycotting the United Nations in June 1950. Since the Soviets were not present, they could not veto the motion, and the proposal to defend South Korea was passed by the UN. That's why it was technically the United Nations forces who were opposing the North Koreans, not the United States. This was the only time until the end of the Cold War that the UN worked like it was supposed to in opposing an aggressor nation. The reason I outlined Harry Truman's opposition to Joseph Stalin and the communist bloc is to point out the absurdity of the claims of Joe McCarthy that the Truman administration was, to use the popular expression of that day, soft on communism. Although they did not use that term in 1950, McCarthy's Lincoln Day speech of February 9 in Wheeling, West Virginia, went viral. And why wouldn't it? A U.S. senator was accusing the Secretary of State of knowingly permitting 205 communists to work in the State Department. If this was true, this would mean that the international policies and security of the United States were being undermined by communist infiltrators with the help of the Secretary of State. Of course, such an allegation would grab the attention of most Americans as well as people in other countries. As I told you earlier, in 1949, the USSR had detonated its first atomic bomb, and also in 1949, China became communist. So McCarthy's timing was perfect if he wanted to cash in on communist hysteria. It's amazing that people did not immediately realize that McCarthy was lying. He never showed anybody his supposed list. If he really had a list with 205 names of Communist Party members who were working for and undermining the State Department, why wouldn't he publish that list? By concealing their identities, wasn't McCarthy doing what he claimed the Secretary of State was doing, meaning protecting the subversive elements in the U.S. government? Another reason why people should have immediately realized McCarthy was lying was because he kept changing the allegations. At different times, he said there were 205 communists in the State Department, other times 57. At another point, he claimed there were 81 communists in the State Department. If you truly have a list in your hands naming the individuals, why would you keep claiming different numbers of communist subversives? A couple of weeks after his Wheeling, West Virginia speech, McCarthy delivered a lengthy speech to the U.S. Senate. In that speech, McCarthy claimed that there were 81 loyalty risks working for the State Department. But again, McCarthy did not name anybody. Why didn't this raise red flags? And no pun was intended about red flags regarding communists. If a U.S. senator knew of 81 people working in the State Department that were undermining the interests of the United States, why wouldn't he say who they were? Why wouldn't he immediately turn over these names to the FBI? In case some of you might be wondering if McCarthy was worried about getting into legal trouble by accusing specific individuals of being communist traitors, he wasn't worried. Although McCarthy went on to destroy many people's lives, he never faced any legal consequences. Why was that? It's because the first paragraph of Article 1, Section 6 of the U.S. Constitution reads, "The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. They shall, in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same. And for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place." That last segment is typically referred to as the speech or debate clause. The idea was to protect the independence and integrity of members of Congress from possible repercussions by either the executive branch, meaning the president, or the judicial branch. The speech or debate clause has also been interpreted to protect members of Congress from being sued by private individuals. This was addressed in the 1979 U.S. Supreme Court case of Hutchinson versus Proxmire. And for my fellow attorneys out there, the citation is 443 U.S. 111. In that case, Senator William Proxmire was being sued by a man named Ronald Hutchinson for defamation. Proxmire had made disparaging remarks about Hutchinson's research, which was paid for by the federal government. Proxmire was a senator from Wisconsin. Fun fact, he was elected in a special election to fill the Senate seat that had been recently vacated by the death of the subject of today's episode, Joseph McCarthy. Although Proxmire was a Democrat and McCarthy was a Republican. Anyway, in that 1979 case, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on whether Senator Proxmire's activities and statements against Hutchinson were protected by the speech or debate clause of Article 1, Section 6 of the Constitution. The court ruled that Proxmire's statements on the floor of the Senate and any discussions with his staff were certainly protected by the speech or debate clause of the Constitution. However, statements made by Senator Proxmire in his newsletters and press releases were not protected by the speech or debate clause because they were not essential to the deliberations of the Senate, nor were they part of the legislature's deliberative process. The point of all this is that as long as they limit their statements to the floor of Congress, senators and representatives can say anything and cannot be prosecuted or sued. After McCarthy's February 1950 speech to the Senate regarding the alleged loyalty risks in the State Department, the Senate established the Subcommittee on the Investigation of Loyalty of State Department Employees. This committee is usually referred to as the Tidings Committee because the chairman was Senator Millard Tidings, a Democrat from Maryland. The Tidings Committee held hearings from March until July 1950. The Tidings Committee issued a report that stated McCarthy's charges were a fraud and a hoax. On June 1, 1950, one of McCarthy's colleagues spoke out against him. This was Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine. She was the only female senator at that time, and she's the first woman to be elected to both houses of Congress. Although she did not mention McCarthy by name, Smith read a Declaration of Conscience signed by six fellow Republicans, which read in pertinent part, "I think it is high time that we remembered that we have sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution. I think it is high time that we remembered that the Constitution, as amended, speaks not only of the freedom of speech, but also of trial by jury instead of trial by accusation, whether it be a criminal prosecution in court or a character prosecution in the Senate. There is little practical distinction when the life of a person has been ruined." So that was the end of it, right? McCarthy was discredited and crawled back into the shadows. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. McCarthy continued his accusations about communists. And for a while, he also found a new target, gay people. In the 1950s, people in the LGBTQ community could not be open about their sexual orientation. At the time, this was known as the Lavender Scare. Anybody who was discovered to be gay was fired from any government position. The theory was this: gays were prime targets for blackmail and therefore security risks. But when you think about this, it's a circular argument. The reason why gay people were susceptible to blackmail was the fact that they would be fired if it was discovered that they were gay. So, once it was discovered that somebody was gay, they would be fired because they were a risk for being blackmailed. Of course, if the government stopped firing people simply because they were gay, then they would not be such easy targets for blackmail. But this was the 1950s. Time for a little side note. The term McCarthyism was coined by a cartoonist for the Washington Post in March 1950. Good job by that cartoonist, Herbert Block, for coming up with a term so early in the McCarthy hysteria. McCarthy continued to attack Truman and his entire administration. One of the primary targets for McCarthy's accusations was George Marshall. Very few people have had a resume to equal George Marshall. During World War II, he was the chief of staff of the United States Army. His decisions were instrumental in the Allies defeating the Axis powers. Marshall later served as the Secretary of State. Remember earlier I mentioned about the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. And then he served as Secretary of Defense during the Truman administration. Yet in a 1951 speech, McCarthy stated that George Marshall was soft on communism and was fostering governmental policies that enhanced Soviet objectives. Although his tactics and his accusations were way over the line, a lot of people viewed McCarthy as attacking the opposing party. However, his crazy antics continued when Republican Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952. In that same year, McCarthy was reelected as senator from Wisconsin. As a result of the 1952 election, the Republicans controlled the Senate, the House of Representatives, and the White House. A lot of naive people thought that McCarthy would stop attacking the federal government. But they were wrong. He didn't care that his own party controlled the national government. With the new Congress, McCarthy hoped to be placed onto the Senate's Internal Security Subcommittee. He figured that would be the committee that would investigate communists. But Senate Majority Leader Robert Taft wanted to sideline McCarthy so he would not stir up more trouble against the Republican administration. McCarthy ended up on the Senate Committee on Government Operations. What the Senate Majority Leader did not consider was that the Committee on Government Operations included the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. McCarthy decided that the directives for the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations included investigating whether communists had infiltrated the federal government. McCarthy appointed Roy Cohn as chief counsel. Remember earlier when I said to keep his name in mind? Yes, this was one of the prosecuting attorneys in the case against Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. McCarthy did most of his damage as the chairman of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. One of his first targets was the Voice of America. The Voice of America still exists today. On its website, this agency of the U.S. government describes itself as follows. The Voice of America, VOA, is an international multimedia broadcaster with service in more than 40 languages. Voice of America provides news, information, and cultural programming through the internet, mobile, and social media, radio, and television. The Voice of America was established during World War II, but it hit its stride during the Cold War. Starting in 1947, the Voice of America broadcast Russian language programs into the Soviet Union. These broadcasts included American music as well as news stories. The Soviet government hated these broadcasts and tried to jam them whenever possible. So, if the Soviet government was against the Voice of America, it's hard to believe that Joe McCarthy could claim that the VOA was infiltrated by communists working against the interests of the United States and in favor of the USSR. But those were his claims. McCarthy's tactics were to subpoena people into his subcommittee hearings. He would berate these people and question them whether they were then or had ever been a communist. And if they had never been a communist, did they have any close friends or relatives who had ever been communists? McCarthy was very big on guilt by association. If you were related to somebody who had been a communist at some point in their life, or you were friends with somebody who had been a communist, that meant you were guilty as well. But McCarthy did not prove that anybody he hauled in front of his committee committed any crimes. As I said earlier, his investigations did not lead to anybody going to jail for subversive activities. McCarthy usually did not even prove that somebody was an actual communist. He just made allegations and innuendos that people were suspected of being communists or were friendly with other people who may have been communists. McCarthy's committee also investigated the U.S. State Department libraries located in Europe. He sent Roy Cohn to investigate these libraries and make a list of books from controversial persons, communists, fellow travelers, etc. Banning books because somebody in authority disapproves of them, does that sound like any despicable government from the 1930s and 40s you can think of? McCarthy was not a great speaker, but he did know how to rile up a crowd. Here's a famous clip of one of his speeches in 1952.
One communist on the faculty of one university is one communist too many. One communist among the American advisors at Yalta was one communist too many. And even if there were only one communist in the State Department, even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
Since his speech in Wheeling, West Virginia in February 1950, up through the fall of 1953, very few people were willing to stand up to him. Everybody was afraid to cross him because then McCarthy might go after them. One of the few to stand up to McCarthy was Edward R. Murrow. He was a famous journalist at that time who had a very influential TV news show called See It Now. On the March 9, 1954 episode of See It Now, Murrow called out McCarthy as a bully who was destroying people's lives and creating fear with no evidence whatsoever. This was the beginning of the end for Joe McCarthy. What really led to McCarthy's downfall were the Army-McCarthy hearings in the U.S. Senate. McCarthy had been making allegations of lax security at a top-secret Army facility, which McCarthy said led to communist infiltration. However, there were also accusations by the Army against McCarthy. These were related to a man named David Shine. Shine had been an aide to Joe McCarthy and was a close friend of Roy Cohn. Shine had accompanied Roy Cohn in the summer of 1953 in that incident that I described earlier when they went to investigate subversion in the offices of American agencies in Europe. They reviewed books and libraries of American embassies and consulates. Some officials at the International Information Administration actually lost their jobs because Cohn and Shine found some detective stories that happened to be written by a pro-communist author. In the fall of 1953, David Shine had been drafted into the Army. There were allegations that McCarthy and Roy Cohn had tried to use their connections to get an officer's commission and other preferential treatment for David Shine. To investigate these charges by McCarthy of lack of security at a top-secret Army facility, as well as the charges against McCarthy and Roy Cohn for the undue influence seeking preferential treatment for their friend and colleague, David Shine, hearings were held. For these hearings, McCarthy stepped down as chairman of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. He had to because he was one of the people being investigated during these particular hearings. However, McCarthy did get to question people. These hearings were televised. That might not seem like a big deal today, but this was huge in 1954. There was hardly anything on TV in the mid-1950s, especially during the day. The public was riveted to their TVs. Before I describe the Army-McCarthy hearings, let me take a little detour. If you're wondering what happened to some of these people, here's an interesting tidbit about David Shine. He left politics and went into business. He was the executive producer of the 1971 film The French Connection. I know that was over 50 years ago, but that movie was huge. Shine died in a plane crash in 1996 at the age of 69. It was a small plane piloted by Shine's son here in Southern California. As for Roy Cohn, he went on to have a long and infamous legal career. He represented people in the mafia, and a young Donald Trump considered Roy Cohn his mentor. Cohn died on August 2, 1986, at the age of 59 from AIDS. Although he denied being gay for a long time, it came out that Roy Cohn actually was gay. But that did not stop him from prosecuting gay men during the Lavender Scare I mentioned earlier when Cohn was chief counsel to Joseph McCarthy. Back to the Army-McCarthy hearings. The findings of the hearings included that Joe McCarthy did not, but Roy Cohn did, use undue influence on the Army for preferential treatment for David Shine. But that wasn't important. The hearings went from April 22 to June 17, 1954. Some of the hearings were watched by 20 million people. The fact that millions of Americans were watching these televised hearings was a very bad thing for Joe McCarthy. This was the critical fact from the Army-McCarthy hearings. People saw that he was not a crusader trying to protect the American public from communist subversives. They saw that he was just a very aggressive bully who was attacking people without justification. The chief counsel for the Army was named Joseph Welch. He was a private lawyer from Boston at the firm of Hale and Dorr. Welch was the key figure in the memorable incident which essentially ended the reign of terror by Joe McCarthy. Joseph Welch and Roy Cohn had made a deal not to discuss two issues which were irrelevant to the Army-McCarthy hearings but could prove embarrassing. Although Roy Cohn was physically fit and of draft age, he had somehow avoided the Korean War and had never been drafted. Welch told Cohn that he would not raise the issue of Cohn's draft status if Cohn would not go into the background of Fred Fisher. That was an attorney who worked at Welch's firm of Hale and Dorr. While at Harvard Law School, Fred Fisher had belonged to the National Lawyers Guild. The National Lawyers Guild had been accused of being a front group for communists. Anyway, the deal between Welch and Cohn was that nobody would raise Cohn's draft status or raise Fred Fisher's involvement with the National Lawyers Guild. The problem arose during a hearing on June 9, 1954. McCarthy broke this agreement that Welch and Roy Cohn had reached and brought up Fred Fisher. Here is that famous exchange. The first voice you will hear will be McCarthy, and then you'll hear Joe Welch in reply.
Chairman, may I say that Mr. Welch talks about this being cruel and reckless. He was just baiting. He has been baiting Mr. Cohn here for hours, requesting that Mr. Cohn, before sundown, get out of any department of the government anyone who is serving the communist cause. Now, I just give this man's record. And I want to say, Mr. Welch, that it has been labeled long before he became a member, as early as 1944.
Senator, may we not drop this? We know he belongs to the Lawyers Guild. And Mr. Cohn nods his head at me. I did you, I think, no personal injury, Mr. Cohn.
No, sir.
I meant to do you no personal injury. And if I did, I beg your pardon. Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
There are certain put-downs that become iconic. Joseph Welch saying to McCarthy, "Have you no sense of decency, sir?" has become one of those quintessential insults in American political history. When Welch left the hearing room a little bit later, most of the audience broke into loud applause. McCarthy never recovered from that incident broadcast on live television. Republican Senator Ralph E. Flanders introduced a resolution to censure McCarthy. And yes, you heard me right, it was a Republican senator who brought this resolution. A censure in Congress does not have any legal effect. It simply expresses disapproval of that person for their actions. The resolution for censure was introduced on July 30, 1954. There was an investigation into McCarthy's tactics, and a vote was taken on December 2, 1954. The Senate voted 67-22 to censure Joe McCarthy. He was no longer somebody to be feared. He no longer had any power. He became an irrelevant person and was essentially ignored by the other members of Congress and, more importantly, the media. McCarthy had been reelected in 1952. Senators serve a 6-year term, so his term of office would not end until the next election in 1958 and the swearing-in of the new Congress in January 1959. But McCarthy did not live that long. He died on May 2, 1957. He was only 48 years old. The death certificate listed the cause of death as hepatitis, but in reality, Joe McCarthy drank himself to death. Most historians accept that McCarthy died of cirrhosis of the liver from his severe alcohol consumption. The listing of hepatitis as the cause of death was considered a kind gesture. So what's the legacy of Joe McCarthy? As I outlined in this episode, the spread of communism throughout different parts of the world was a legitimate threat. But McCarthy's tactics as a demagogue, persecuting innocent people with no basis whatsoever, was a terrible injustice. It's true that there had been some Soviet agents, but law enforcement agencies like the FBI in the US and MI5 in Britain were the proper channels to capture such subversive threats. Wild and unfounded accusations in the newspapers and on television and in Senate hearings did not uncover any Soviet agents. McCarthy's tactics merely destroyed the lives of many innocent Americans. It's estimated that 10 to 12,000 Americans lost their jobs because of Joe McCarthy. A large percentage were in the private sector. Employers did not want to employ people who had been accused of being communists. And Joe McCarthy laid out the blueprint for how to run a political witch hunt. He would make accusations, and if the people in the media delved into these accusations and found out that they were false, McCarthy didn't retreat or even reply. He just made new accusations against new people. This is how you keep a political witch hunt going. That's it for today. Please subscribe to this podcast. Please like this and my other episodes. Reviews greatly help. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, it's easy to do. Scroll down the History Analyze show page, select a rating, hopefully 5 stars, and then tap write a review. If you're listening on Spotify or any other podcast apps which allow ratings, I would greatly appreciate a 5-star rating. Please tell your friends, relatives, and coworkers. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the audience for History Analyzed. Check out my website, historyanalyzed.com. Thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.